This is an interview with Theodore Sondi by Kenneth Durr for the SEC Historical Society, being held on April 4th, 2005 at the offices of Hogan and Hartson.
I want to start off with a brief recap of some of your early background, your education, how you came to the SEC, and what you were up to for the first couple of years.
Let's start at the education. I went to City College in New York. Uptown was a philosophy major, went to NYU Law School. I ended up at the SEC because I had spent my last summer before my last year of law school at a large Wall Street firm and didn't find it very challenging. Had a classmate who was ahead of me in college and law school who had gone to work at the SEC, told me what a wonderful time he was having. And so I'd never taken a securities course, didn't know anything about it, decided to go. Went down during the Kennedy presidency, got hired just before he was assassinated, showed up when Johnson was president in the summer of 1964.
And you went in the corporate regulation?
Division of corporate regulation, which then handled what used to be called Chapter 10 proceedings, where public companies went into bankruptcy. Today they're called Chapter 11 proceedings, and at that time the SEC's role was more significant than it is today in typical bankruptcy proceedings, even of public large public companies. Was there, met some great people, was not particularly satisfied with the job. Paul Gonson, who spent a long career at the Commission, and I think is a former president of the Historical Society, was my first supervisor, and Paul and I learned a little bit about appellate work, and then I moved to the general counsel's office after about a year and a half, and proceeded to spend another 8 years there, I guess, moving from staff attorney to ultimately assistant general counsel until I moved to the enforcement division in 1974.
And this is the point at which you start to become involved in some of these cases, the accountant cases, I guess, was the phrase you used
earlier. Well, I started, I had sort of two roles in the general counsel's office. I started out as a young lawyer learning how to write an appellate brief and worked very closely with a great teacher and great lawyer named Dave Ferber. Ferber was the solicitor and spent many years with him. I also ended up working on, because I had some interest in doing trial work, got assigned to a case called Fifth Avenue Coach, which turned out to be my first real exposure to lawyer cases and accountants cases. In that case, we ended up suing one lawyer named Tom Bolin, who was a named partner of a fairly prominent firm called Sachs, Bacon & Bolin. And later we ended up suing his colleague, I don't know whether to call him a partner or not, because I still didn't know whether he was a partner, Roy Cohn. And the two of them provided me with my first education on how some lawyers practice law. We ended up succeeding by establishing the case against both of them, and read a lot of what were then memos and interesting documents suggesting that perhaps they were into things that they shouldn't have been into.
What kind of things were they doing?
Well, the basic scheme that Fifth Avenue Coach was a successor or a predecessor company, used to run the bus lines in New York City. Sometime, I want to say in the late 50s, the city of New York seized the bus lines and sort of nationalized them, if you want to call it that. And so New York City, the Fifth Avenue Coach's business stopped being running buses, and it basically had a claim for a lawsuit for damages for the assets. Turned out to be a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars. And what happened was we had discovered, not I, but people in the Division of Corporate Regulation, I guess, as well as corporation finance, that the $25 million is a number that sticks in my mind, was somehow missing. And so we brought case based largely on the accountant's work papers. I want to say it was Arthur Anderson at the time, who tried to account for what happened to the $25 million. And we ended up being able to account for about 20 of it, and in effect said that 5 of the 20 was missing. 5 of the 25 was missing, which became the centerpiece for a headline for the New York Post at the time. Fifth Avenue Coach ended up being essentially an unregistered investment company, and that was the regulatory handle that we used to try to establish that it was an unregistered investment company and that any form of self-dealing was prohibited under the Investment Company Act, and that was the handle that we used. And the lawyers essentially showed the businessmen how to get around the regulatory structure in a way which I thought was just totally wrong. There were some comical emails, not emails, there were no emails, there were some comical memos to indicate, well, I didn't ask for your business advice or things like that, when some of the associates would say, you can't do this, and somebody said, who asked you, or something like that. And but there were a series of things that they did, various investments that they made that just didn't make any economic sense.
Now, you would have started this case by going after the principals, I would assume, rather than the lawyers and the accountants.
Well, the way that, when you say started this case, we did not go after the accountants in the Nationals, in the Fifth Avenue Coach case. We went after the businessmen, as you say. But the case would come to me in the general counsel's office, and did come to me after it had already been put together by one of the operating divisions. And in this case, it was the Division of Corporate Regulation and the part of it which basically dealt with mutual funds. And I remember meetings and discussions that we had where they had essentially put the case together and had recommended that case be brought against two business people, as well as Tom Bolin, and they were going to be alleging an unregistered investment company, and general counsel's office was going to be responsible for trying the case, and I was a young staff attorney, and had a lot of fun at it. At the same time, I learned a lot. But the case had already been packaged. I want to say Sid Mendelson was the one who originally was in charge of this enforcement function.
The point that I was getting to is this was a lawyer case, so to speak.
Yes.
There probably wasn't at this early date a sense of establishing the groundwork for something in the way that some of the later lawyer cases would have done.
I think that's true. I think that historically this case had nothing to do with the legal profession. It turned out to be a lawyer's case, if you want to call it that, because the commission ended up suing two lawyers who were outside counsel, or allegedly outside counsel, to a corporate defendant. I only identified as a lawyer's case because it was sort of the beginning of my education into some of the legal shenanigans that I thought lawyers shouldn't be doing.
Well, let's move on to the next step in that education.
After Fifth Avenue Coach, there were a series of cases that were brought. There were a series of cases brought by the commission against lawyers who were doing things that I don't think any respectable lawyer would think of doing. Sometimes they were simply outright securities fraud, where you would have an offering which had a minimum of, say, $5 million, and they would close it with $3 million and then paper over the fact that there was $2 million missing. Or they would engage in other things that were providing legal opinions where securities would be exempt from registration when there was no legal basis for it. And I ended up with a couple of those cases. The Spectrum case, for one, was a case that was brought out of the New York Regional Office, which was pretty much a stock scam of one sort. But involved a lawyer's opinion, and it was decided that we should argue. The case was against I'm not sure I remember his name correctly, but I want to say it was Stuart Schiffman. I don't know whether that's right or not. The case was argued to the Second Circuit about the importance of a lawyer's opinion. There had been a case called United States versus Benjamin that had been decided by the Second Circuit that talked about how a lawyer's opinion or an accountant's opinion could be a tool for fraud. And the Second Circuit in the Spectrum case took off on that and expanded on that. At the same time, there were a series of, I would call them, lawyers who facilitated different kinds of crimes and frauds that got themselves involved in different kinds of activity, and the Commission decided to address more and more of that in one form or another. We had situations where I think it was a lawyer named Kaufman had been criminally convicted of securities fraud in New York but was still practicing before the New York Bar. Commission decided to amend its Rule 2E rules to try to deal with that. I got involved in a couple of cases involving accountants, which I thought somewhat analogous to lawyers. There was a case that I worked on, an amicus case in the Southern District of New York, which established an important accounting principle, really a legal principle that I thought had application to both the legal profession and the accounting profession, called Fisher versus Kletz, where basically the court said that anyone who provides some form of identification, like a lawyer or an accountant or a legal opinion, to a statement that they know is no longer true, has a duty to correct that and use the restatement of torts. And I thought that was sort of an interesting stepping stone. It involved the bankruptcy of a company called Yale Express and the accounting firm of Pete Marwick and Mitchell at the time. And the accounting profession, interestingly, I thought, and very responsibly, took that case and adopted that principle into its professional rules of conduct. I don't necessarily mean their code of conduct, but more on what are the standards for the profession when they learn that, for example, a set of financial statements are no longer correct. And out of that case and that same principle evolved the notion that it's incumbent upon accountants to disassociate themselves from financial statements that are no longer correct. And you have today the whole notion of restating financial statements, which is really an offspin of this whole notion. At the same time, I got involved in a case involving Westech, which was a collapse of a company in the 60s, involving a 2E case against two of what were then partners of Ernst & Ernst. And I also developed a relationship with Andy Barr, who was the chief accountant of the commission and was sort of the gatekeeper for all accounting cases. And we worked together on a number of cases, and one of them was the National Student Marketing case, as well as a couple of other cases against accountants and lawyers. And we worked through the professional obligations in the National Student Marketing case, first against what was then Pete Marwick and Mitchell, and a number of its professionals, an audit partner who ran the Washington, D.C. office named Tony Natelli, and the audit manager on the job, and also against the law firms of White & Case and Lord Bissell & Brook.
Let's back up just a bit before we start into the National Student Marketing case. Andy Barr, he's the chief accountant all through this period. What was his...
Yes. I want to say even before that. He was an institution at that point. Yeah. But I want to say he left in the early to middle 70s, right after... Oh, okay, you know better than I do.
A lot of stuff happened in 72.
Okay, but I think my recollection is he was on board with the National Student Marketing case.
Fisher versus Kletz is not the kind of thing where... Would he have taken notice and said, let's think this through, let's look at what we're doing here?
I don't remember whether he actually was consulted, but I would have thought he would have been, because as I recall, we were requested by the district judge to provide him with an amicus brief, and the commission did provide an amicus brief. I want to say it's District Judge Tyler, and I know Mike Eisenberg, who was the assistant general counsel that I worked for at the time, and I worked on the accounting position that the commission took in that case, and I don't know whether I actually remember it, but I'm pretty sure that was run past Andy Bohr.
Okay. So National Student Marketing, what kind of company was this, and what were the issues?
Well, National Student Marketing was a marketing company, and its claim to fame was that it claimed to have a campus-driven network of students who worked on a part-time basis who would promote your products nationwide on college campuses. And they allegedly had agreements with the Pontiac division of General Motors. They had agreements with American Airlines and with other companies, large companies, to promote their marketing skills. They had gone from a very small company to a fairly large one in the mid to late 60s, and then in the late 60s, their stock collapsed. The company was run by a fellow named Cortez Randall. Randall ended up going to jail for this, among other scams. He was pretty incorrigible, and he surrounded himself with good professionals. When I got the case, which was in the late 1971, I guess, because the case itself was filed in early 72, we learned that originally National Student Marketing had been represented by Covington and Burling here in town and Arthur Anderson. And both of them had fired Court Randall and his company, and they were succeeded by White & Case in New York and a young partner named Jay Epley, and by Pete Mulligan Mitchell here in town. And they were a D.C.-based company that had been a high-flying stock for a period of time. And the case itself had two facets. National Student Marketing claimed to its auditors that you could book contracts and revenue before you actually had a contract. And so you had oral agreements to provide services, hypothetically, for the Pontiac division of General Motors. And indeed, there was some purported agreement. The notion was that we did most of our work in planning the marketing program, and we would get a contract, and by the time we got the contract, we had put in most of the work. We had the billboards ready to go out, or the flyers, or the promotional pieces, and so all the money was earned before you actually got the contract. Not a very sound notion. As I recall, they had some, they fell back on a percentage of completion accounting, which makes some sense in the construction industry, but made no sense whatsoever in this. But somehow they convinced the auditors to do that. In 1967, they had a sizable profit based on these so-called oral commitments. When they brought the case to me, it became apparent that the oral commitments, by the time the middle of 1968 had occurred, had fallen apart. And so much of this revenue was wrong. But instead of correcting the financial statements for 1967, they went on a binge to acquire a whole bunch of companies to, in effect, cover up the fact that they didn't have any income or earnings. The criminal case against Tony Natale largely evolved around the fact that by the time the proxy statement went out for a large $40 million merger, they already knew that the financial statements that had previously been published were wrong. And instead of admitting that they were wrong and calling for their restatement, it was alleged that he caused certain adjustments to be made to hide the fact that the numbers were wrong. And that was ultimately considered to be the underlying criminal offense. What happened in 1968 was that the one of the conditions for this same merger was that there was to be a comfort letter delivered, which would in effect say that there were no material adjustments required to both the unaudited and audited financial statements that were in the proxy statement. Pete Marwick, Mr. Natale, concluded that in fact there were material adjustments, and the material adjustments were such that they would wipe out all of the income in the 9-month financial statements and require a restatement. They tried to present that comfort letter to the closing, where the two companies, in this case it was National Student Marketing and a company called Interstate National Corporation, were merging. And this was taking place at the offices of White & Case in New York. And Pete Wog was having trouble convincing the people in New York that they should abort the merger. And so what evolved was a situation where Pete Marwick ended up delivering a comfort letter the following week, which in effect said that the financial statements were wrong, they needed to be restated, and the stockholders needed to have new and corrected financial statements circulated to them. Well, unknown to Pete Marwick, for most of what was a Friday afternoon, the closing proceeded without the signed comfort letter. And much to the frustration of then Vic Earle, who was the then general counsel of Pete Marwick, he couldn't convince the lawyers at White & Case to abort the closing. So he added paragraphs, which he thought was being delivered to the closing room, but some of which wasn't until after it closed. The commission took the position that the two law firms had basically aided and abetted securities fraud by allowing the closing to proceed in light of the comfort letter, and concluded that they should have aborted the closing and stopped the closing to go forward. The commission also alleged that Pete Marwick, even though it had done quite a bit, had failed in its professional obligation in that instead of following the teachings of Fisher versus Klutz and the accounting literature that was extended at the time, should have come to the commission. Because there was literature out there that said that you have to disassociate yourself from financial statements that you know are incorrect. And if you advise the client to correct it and the client refuses, you have an obligation to bring it to the attention of the proper regulatory authorities, which in the accounting literature was described as either the stock exchange or the SEC. And so the commission in the complaint basically said Pete Marwick failed in that respect. That was a small aspect of the case as it related to Pete Marwick, but it was important from a precedential point of view to make clear that the accountants had this obligation, and indeed the lawyers had that obligation. As we were drafting the complaint, it occurred to me that there was really no logical reason why the lawyers didn't have the same legal obligation, particularly under the then ethics rules, was then called the Code of Professional Conduct. It was an ABA Code of Professional Conduct, which was the same as in the state of New York and in most states around the country. There are minor variations. But basically, the ABA Code, as well as the New York Code, required a lawyer to disassociate himself or herself from a financial fraud that the client knew, that the lawyer knew was being perpetrated against some person. And the way that the rules read, the lawyer was required to basically call upon the client to rectify the fraud, and if failing that, to report it to the affected person or tribunal. And we took it as a given that that was appropriate to apply to the lawyers as well. And so we drafted a paragraph, which became somewhat of an infamous paragraph, saying that the lawyers had a duty to blow the whistle. And frankly, didn't spend a lot of time thinking about the revolution we were about to start, but we talked about it. I remember reviewing it with Alan Levinson. I remember viewing it with the then general counsel, Brad Cook. I know Dick Rowe was consulted and other people, and we all thought it made sense. Of course, the legal profession didn't think it made sense, and they promptly decided to change the rules and concluded that this was far beyond the call of the legal profession. And essentially, there were law review articles, there were press reports and the like about it. To this day, I don't think they still accept the notion. It always seemed to me fairly simple that if you're a lawyer and you know that you've put together documents, say, for a simple real estate closing, and your client tells you the morning of the closing, you don't need to come to the closing because I've gotten tickets to Brazil and I'm about to steal all the proceeds. And by the way, all the documents I gave you that you based your opinion on are all forgeries and fraudulent. you have a professional obligation to call up the lawyer on the other side and say you shouldn't go to the closing and tell him what you need to do to stop that. It didn't seem to me to be terribly earth-shattering. When put in that light, most lawyers would agree. But put in the corporate light, somehow it became startling. And it seemed to me that if you look at the actual language of the National Student Marketing Complaint, you'll see that the paragraph that applies to the lawyers is parallel to the paragraph that applies to the accounting profession, and it says they should have basically called upon the client to rectify the financial statements and failing that to report to the SEC, and that was considered blasphemy.
Well, revolution was your word, and clearly this did make a big splash. Can you give some sense of why this may have seemed so novel to the legal profession when you were essentially building on what had been established in another profession, in the accounting profession?
Well, I think that there were two parts of it that were novel. I think the real novelty, if there was anything novel about it, was that the commission, for the first time in its history, was suing a major law firm for securities fraud. And not only a major law firm, but a very respected firm that had an international reputation. And it was claiming that it had committed securities fraud, or it had facilitated securities fraud. And I think that was really the revolution, if there was a revolution. The commission drew no attention from the bar when it sued the little old practitioner who did something stupid, the Stuart Schiffmans, the Kaufmans, the Ezrines, the Fields. Nobody cared. Went after a partner in a major law firm, much less two law firms and three partners, two in one firm and partner in another, and charged them with securities fraud. That was the revolution. The legal attack that they mounted, or the, if you want to call it political attack, they had mounted against the legal theory was a cover, I thought, to what was really thought of as unheard of and unprecedented, which is to go after the large professional organizations. And you have to bear in mind, at this point, there had been very few cases brought against the major accounting firms. There had been very few cases brought against the major law firms. There were no cases that I was aware of where partners of major law firms had been sued. I think there was one case that had been brought in, the Continental Vending case, against the partner of what was then Liber and Ross Brothers, which is a predecessor to Coopers and Liber and PricewaterhouseCoopers. That was unprecedented. The fact that we sued Pete Marwick and Mitchell, and we sued two people associated with it, I think that was unprecedented. And the 70s brought about a series of cases like that. In addition to the National Student Marketing case, the commission brought the Vesco case, where it sued three lawyers associated with the New York law firm of Wilkie Farr and Gallagher, very well-known firm. You know, if my memory serves me correctly, one of the defendants who was a partner of that firm was the former director of the SEC's Division of Corporate Regulation, a fellow named Alan Conwell. The bar took notice of that as well. There followed a number of other cases where major firms and partners of major firms, law firms and accounting firms, were being sued. There was a case against Arthur Anderson in the Four Seasons case, where there was a criminal prosecution, if I remember correctly. At that point, Andy Barr had left the commission and Sandy Burton had become the chief accountant. And I remember when Sandy came on board, I went through with him the various allegations in the National Student Marketing case and had gone through other accounting cases. We were then beginning to start what turned out to be a long series of cases against accounting firms. We had the Ampex case. I think that was against Touche Ross. We had Four Seasons. We had the Geotech case, which involved a case against Arthur Young and Company. We had, and there were some lawyers involved in that one, but not prominent law firms. There were three or four cases brought against Pete Marwick at that time. One was Penn Central. Another one was Sterling Homex. another one's name is escaping me at the moment, but also
there's plenty of them in there.
Yeah.
Now, are you working on trying these cases through the general counsel's office?
Well, originally the general counsel's office would handle some but not all of the enforcement cases. There was no division of enforcement until around 1974, I think. And the general counsel's office was handling at that time cases like the National Student Marketing case, which came out of the Division of Corporation Finance and the enforcement component of CorpFin that was handled by Dick Rowe at the time and Alan Levinson before that. The general counsel's office handled at that point the Texas Gulf Sulphur case. It handled the Vesco case and a number of other cases that for one reason or another were being handled there and before the enforcement division was created. I was supervising the Penn Central case. I want to say that moves into the early 70s because I want to say the large settlement that the commission reached with Pete Mowick was in the mid-70s after I had moved to the enforcement division.
And National Student Marketing starts early. It makes this big splash around 72 or so. But you're still involved in that for years afterwards.
I was involved in it till it was over. It went through the usual ebbs and flows of litigation. I then learned how long it can take to get a case to trial. This particular case was particularly challenging. The judge, a wonderful judge named Barrington Parker, had a terrible car accident in the middle of it, lost a leg, and literally crossing Connecticut Avenue to get a pack of cigarettes. And nothing very dramatic, but it stayed with him through the end, and he resumed his time on the bench after recuperation and everything else. And I think he was actually disappointed when we ended up settling the National Student Marketing case against White and Case and had then only the trial of the innocents, as my adversary, Lord Bissell and Brooke, talked about. Actually, it was Hogan and Hartson who was my adversary. That's where I met them for the first time and where I am now.
We're moving into the 70s, and it seems like a lot of things happen around 72, and we're talking about lawyers and accountants. Is there a sense that some of these lawyer and accountant cases, something as novel as, and I'm getting the sense that it's novel, as the National Student Marketing case, led to any kind of repercussions within the SEC? Changes in approach, anything like that?
Well, I think what was happening in the early 70s, you have to go back to the times to some extent. You had Watergate taking place. Nixon had been president from 1968 or early 69 forward, and we had Hamer Budget originally as chairman and then Bill Casey. And I don't remember anything. I mean, let me say this, Ken. The history of the securities laws, you can go back to 1930s. You'll see that even before the 34 Act was passed, there's a lot written about how the legal profession essentially disserved itself and its clients by facilitating various kinds of corporate wrongdoing. And there's a lot of literature, whether you go back to Justice Douglas or other people who recognized that as corporate counsels, they had different kinds of obligations, both to the corporate owner as well as to the managers, and how they carried that out and whether they facilitated improper conduct or not. But the 70s, I think, gave rise to Watergate. Watergate gave rise to some of the corporate slush funds. Watergate also focused our attention on what we thought were the failures of the accounting profession to do its job, which led to a bunch of the Pete Mowick cases. Clearly, Sandy Burton, as the SEC's chief accountant, took it upon himself to very conscientiously look on at the accounting cases on the merits. I'm not sure that Sandy Burton was unique in that, but it was viewed by most of the staff as being unique. Yes. I think that Andy Barr had a different sense of how to accomplish the job and didn't see it as consistent with his view and role of the accounting profession to go after them so much as to try to teach them lessons in a different way. And I think that that came into disarray, disrespect at that point, and people felt that more had to be done to convince the accounting profession that they had to be more stand-up-ish with their clients and say no when they needed to say no.
Okay. At this point, you're starting to head into your transition from the general counsel's office into enforcement. What was the opportunity? Who approached you? And what led to your decision to move?
Well, what happened was, not sure the exact sequence, but I remember Stanley Sporkin had become the director of the division, I want to say shortly before I went down there, and Stanley had asked me to come down to the division, I think initially to be head of the trial unit and take some of the cases that were in general counsel's office and put them in the trial unit, and I can't remember the exact discussion, but it was agreed that I would become an associate director in charge of both the trial unit and the chief counsel's office. And at that point, both of them reported to me. I was not involved on a day-to-day basis with any of the underlying investigations, which were being handled by the other operating branches and the other associate directors. I was responsible more for some policy issues and also for the trial unit, and tried to work around a group of lawyers that had some trial experience and, frankly, bring on some people who had a lot more experience, which we did over the years.
Can you unpack that a little bit and talk specifically about the function of the trial unit within the Division of Enforcement?
Sure. The trial unit's principal function was to basically handle cases in two categories. There were a group of cases that it had inherited, such as the National Student Marketing case, such as the VESCO case, and a number of other cases. And it was also charged with picking up cases from the operating units that did not settle. A large percentage of the cases can settle on the filing of the lawsuit or before. A number of cases didn't settle, and we were asked to try those cases. And there were a whole series of cases where people in the trial unit were responsible for handling the case. We had, I want to say, 10 or 15 experienced lawyers, some from private practice, some of them former assistant U.S. attorneys. Probably most of them are leading members of the bar today, one sort or another. Ben Greenspoon had just joined the trial unit before I joined it. He was then 10 years older than I. I was 34 at the time, and Ben was all of 44. I now know he's past 70, as I'm past 65. But we hired, there was a fellow there named Bob LaPrade, who was the chief trial attorney. Wonderful, wonderful human being. And we hired we hired Greg Glenn, who was a former assistant from the Central District of California, Los Angeles, and he picked up the VESCO case, which had been handled by a fellow named Bob Kushner in the general counsel's office. We picked up a fellow named Bob Romano and Frank Rosano, who were from the New Jersey U.S. Attorney's Office. We picked up a number of other experienced lawyers, and we had a pretty good trial shop.
The VESCO case in particular, speaking of high profile, and we've got overlap with Nixon here. Is this a lawyer and accountant case as well?
It's both a lawyer and an accountant case, but it's more a regulatory case It was basically alleged that Vesco had created, in effect, an unregistered investment company used to loot a group of mutual funds that were themselves unregistered because they were offshore. There were allegations against three lawyers from Wilkie, Farr, and Gallagher, a large firm in New York, involved in that. I don't remember there being any charges against the accountants in that case. As I recall, I thought they had. I was not involved in the bringing of the case. I was involved. I actually ended up supervising it once it came down to to enforcement in the early 70s. And it, of course, sprang a series of other cases because it was alleged that Mr. Vesco tried to curry political favor with the committee to reelect the president and allegedly contributed $250,000 in a suitcase to Maurice Stans, who was then the chairman of the committee to reelect the president. And efforts were made to kill the Vesco investigation, and we discovered that there was $250,000 missing from the Vesco corporate entity. And eventually we sent, and I shouldn't say we because it wasn't me, but Stanley was running the case, Stanley Sporkin, and they sent a subpoena to the committee to reelect the president, which was pretty gutsy. And the story is, and this is all public in the Watergate hearings, that John Dean called Bill Casey, the chairman of the SEC at the time, and told him to kill the subpoena. Casey was smart enough to ask Sporkin what to do. Sporkin allegedly told Casey to call John Dean back and tell him to comply with the subpoena, and that someday Casey would thank him. And sure enough, that's what happened. Shortly after Irv Pollack became a commissioner, after Brad Cook resigned as chairman and Ray Garrett became chairman, John Mitchell and Maurice Stans were indicted for obstruction of justice arising out of the Vesco case. And there's a story, I don't know, Ken, whether it's true or not, but I've heard it so many times I'm not sure I could separate it fact from fiction, but Ray Garrett had become the chairman after Brad Cook had resigned and wanted to try to get the staff's confidence back in the integrity of the commission. He thought the best way to do that was to have Irv Pollack appointed as a commissioner, because everyone trusted Irv and knew that if Irv said something was the way it was, everyone believed him and still believe him. And so the story was that, Sporkin was up at the commission table one day, and Garrett said to Sporkin, would you ask Irv Pollack to come up, because today the president's going to send his nomination over to the Senate to be a commissioner, and I'd like to tell him personally that that's going to happen. And then Sporkin said quite spontaneously, just like Irv, he's most important day of his life, he's out working on a case. And then he proceeded to exclaim, oh my God, he's working on an indictment of the Attorney General. And Ray Garrett said, don't worry, we won't tell the president. And sure enough, Irv was nominated to be a commissioner, and shortly thereafter, Mitchell and Stans were indicted for obstruction. And that was the case that Irv was working on.
That was really close one.
Yes. Well, you had a sense that politics played very little real role in the commission's business, fortunately, and that was a good example of it. You just kept your blinders on and just did the right thing.
Sporkin, at least by some accounts, and others may have had their blinders off at this point, because the Watergate investigations turned up all of these contributions to the committee to reelect the president. And that's where we start to get into the questionable payments cases.
Well, the blinders remained on in the sense that I meant it, Ken, and that you did what you thought the law required you to do, which is not play political favorites. And Stanley, and I think all of us, for the most part, were oblivious to politics and did what we thought made sense. Clearly, all of us were riveted by the Watergate hearings. and the revelations that were coming out about corporate corruption, the millions of dollars that had been contributed in one form or another by some of the best-known corporations to the committee to re-elect the president. At one point, Vic Earle, who was the general counsel of Pete Mowick, who frankly became a friend at the time after when we were negotiating, has told me a story about how they had been approached. Pete Mowick had been approached to make a contribution to the committee to reelect the president, and Vic said to me, "Politics aside, we just don't do that." And he told that to the person who called him, and the person who called him said, "Everybody's doing it, including the largest corporations in the United States." And he said, "Well, everybody could be doing it, but we're not." And as it turned out, and Vic and I used to chat about this, the biggest ones got it too. And so you read about American Airlines, you read about Phillips Petroleum, case involving George Steinbrenner and others. And so it was about a handful of cases. And at one point, I think Stanley was hearing, as we all were, you'd go home at night and listen to the hearings or listen to the replay of the hearings that had taken place during the day. And it was clear that these contributions were being made by some of the allegedly finest corporations in America and being done through some fairly circuitous accounting devices with secret slush funds and off-the-books transactions and Swiss accounts and Bahamian accounts and other kinds of things. And so at one point, Stanley called a meeting of a group of us. I think Alan Levinson joined the group, and we started to brainstorm about how can they be doing this. And someone came up with the idea that they had to be falsifying books and records, and there has to be a system of accountability. And the form of accounting that we required, that is the commission required, called for accounting for assets and liabilities. And if you didn't have a strict accounting for that, how could you have accurate books and records? That was a notion that was fairly alien at the time, because you had a notion of books and records with registered broker-dealers and investment companies, but not with corporate issuers. And nobody really thought that this Section 13A of the 34 Act could be broadly read to say that the books and records of a corporation had to be accurate. It seemed to be a natural, logical consequence of saying that you had to file accurate corporate reports, but the notion that you had to have accurate books and records was something that was perceived of, at least initially, as something more a problem for the accountants who were certifying the financial statements than for SEC jurisdiction. Some of us were very skeptical about it, and I include myself in that. It wasn't clear to me that we weren't piling on something that really didn't need piling on. Of course, I wasn't smart enough to know that we had struck gold. And we started to, you know, make some phone calls. I wasn't me making the phone calls, but people in the enforcement division that started to make phone calls. We'd start to ask for records from the companies that had admitted that they had made bribes. A lot of them questioned our jurisdiction, but provided us with information. I think Levinson deserves credit for creating this voluntary disclosure program, which turned up literally hundreds of companies, the biggest companies in the country, if not the world, with millions and millions of dollars in foreign payments, and which ultimately led to the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. I mean, some of them were staggering. There were stories about one large company, one multinational company I'll leave unmentioned, but they initially came in as part of the voluntary program and said, you know, we've got this slush fund in Italy. We think it's less than $500,000. We're following it up and we'll get back to you. And clearly $500,000 for this company wasn't material, or at least not as it was conceived of. A couple weeks later, we got a report that it was $2 million, not $200,000. Then it turned out to be tens of millions, and then it turned out to be hundreds of millions.
That's material.
Well, we started to think about materiality in a number of different ways. It was always a question about how material was something from a numerical point of view. And even today, you can see the debate in the commission's current releases about whether there is some threshold. And the commission, I've always understood that the commission, that there was no mechanical rule. A lot of the accounting profession thought that a 5% rule existed, and if it was less than 5% of something, it wasn't material. Commission, I thought, always consistently rejected it, but it depended on where it was. I always thought of it as material as being going beyond that, and I think Sporkin and Levinson and the rest of us thought that it was more. We talked about it in terms of how it would impact on the business of the company. For example, if you had to bribe your customers or the personnel of your customers, whether it was selling aircraft engines or selling, you know, widgets in order to market them, that was material for an investor who was going to put his money into the enterprise to know that the only reason we have so many sales is because we sell whatever it is, aircrafts or television sets or oil or whatever, abroad, or we buy it abroad, and the only way we do it is we do it through corrupt practices. And so that was considered material in the sense that there was a threshold of materiality on a financial level and a numbers sense, but there was also a threshold. We also went to the materiality in terms of the integrity of management, the accuracy of the books and records, the business practices and risks. If you had a sizable amount of sales in some Latin American country that was at threat of being expropriated because the local government discovered that you had been corrupting some of their officials, that was material. I got involved in the ITT case. There were questions, all sorts of shenanigans going around that case, but one of them was, you know, the threat that the foreign officials would be killed if we, if the company disclosed to us the names of the foreign officials, and went through various stages of that. I can't remember which country it was, whether it was Libya or Eastern Europe or whatever, but, you know, we were told that they couldn't give us the names or the, even the amounts, because it would bring death and destruction to these people. But there were a series of cases that evolved over this at the same time that, again, we saw more roles for lawyers and accountants. I can't remember a case. I'm sure there was, but I don't remember a case where we brought a case against a lawyer or an accountant for foreign corrupt payments at that time.
Your discussion of what's material and what's not is reasonably, this seems to depend on interpretation. And you're talking about interpretation that's going on within the commission. Would the companies, on the other hand, say to you, well, how are we going to know, how do we know where your interpretation, where you draw the line?
Well,
you want guidance.
Ken, there was almost universal condemnation of the commission's notion that they determine issues of materiality on an ad hoc basis. We always want guidelines. Give us a rule. We'll follow the rule. But the fact is they couldn't come up with a rule. The rule, we came up with so many different situations. Materiality has now been defined by the Supreme Court in a particular way out of the TSC versus Northway case, but if you go back to the Texas Gulf Sulfur case, if you go back to National Student Marketing, everything is a question of what's material. That's the definition of the statute. And what's material, you can talk about it as being important, you can talk about it as significant, you get into some fancy legal arguments about whether something is material or not. But clearly, the securities laws don't define what a company has to say in its annual report. It simply says, describe your business in its simplest terms. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying it, but in the MD&A, the management discussion and analysis, you're supposed to describe your business. You're supposed to describe known trends and uncertainties. That's a phrase out of Regulation SX that's been there for 20, 30 years, if not more, in one form or another. Well, what's the uncertainty? Well, if you sell products abroad in a corrupt manner, there's an uncertainty to your income stream. if you only sell power plants in the third world by bribing the president and, you know, the third world country, there's uncertainty. Well, if you're raising money from the public, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, you ought to tell them about that. If you can only open a power plant and, you know, whatever, that's where you ought to be doing it. And so, you know, what's material? Well, you know, look at the company, look at the financial statements, look at its product. And if you can only sell product through some extraordinary means, it seems to me it's pretty clearly material.
Moving our way through the 70s here, you talked about the questionable payment issues, and you briefly mentioned the voluntary disclosure approach, which came a few years later. My understanding is part of the idea was you were simply getting too busy to handle the crunch.
Well, first of all, you back up. The voluntary disclosure program came almost at the same time, at least the way I remember it, as the Watergate hearings. The Watergate hearings really started in 73. The voluntary disclosure program was essentially completed by the time that the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was enacted in 1977. And there was a report to Congress in 1976 that summarized the then status of the so-called voluntary disclosure program. There's always a judgment that you make in law enforcement, particularly when you're dealing with the white-collar kind of problem, about how much you should do as opposed to how much you should encourage other people to do. If you go back to the access theory that really was Sporkin's theory, I think, and Irv Pollack's theory about how to increase the effectiveness of the commission's enforcement program, it was conceived of that you needed to create incentives to the people who were at the access points to the market. And those were conceived of as the broker-dealers of the world, the investment bankers of the world, the lawyers and the accountants, and encourage them to police themselves. So, for example, in the, can't think of which piece of legislation it is, but somewhere in the 70s, I believe, maybe it's even in the 60s, broker-dealers were asked to accept the duty of supervision. And the way that that supervision worked is the Congress recognized that this was essentially commission policy, that you couldn't police every broker-dealer, every salesman who was trying to peddle some stock. So you said to the Merrill Lynches of the world, it's your duty to supervise those people. If they work under your name and in your office, you have a duty to supervise them. You set up a policing mechanism that provides for supervision of, you know, Joe Q. Crook, and police him. And if you discharge those responsibilities, then we won't hold you responsible. We'll hold him responsible. And that's part of the duty to supervise that exists in the statute. And that relates primarily to broker-dealers. It's been extended now to most areas. But the fact is that it's the same notion. Provide a financial institution, provide a law firm or an accounting firm with a duty to supervise its people. And if you do your job, we won't have to do it for you. And so you bring to us the problem, children. Tell us when someone has stolen money from one of your customers, someone has falsified financial statements. Restate the financial statements. Take corrective action. Today we talk, Ken, about the so-called Seaborn release and the factors that were advertised just before the collapse of Enron, which is still being used. But that wasn't new. You can argue about whether there are any new factors in it, but the commission is always treated, as I think any law enforcement agency does, give people credit for doing the right thing. And so if you find a problem, and we recognize that there are problems, whether it's in the Foreign Corrupt Practices area or otherwise, fix it. Tell us you fixed it. We'll give you credit for it. If we knock on your door, that is, if the government knocks on your door and tells you to fix something, you get less credit than if you find the problem and fix it. And so what the voluntary disclosure program was to let people know, let companies know that we thought there was a high likelihood that there was a problem in a significant number of companies. Turned out we were right to hundreds of companies, to the tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And so we said, clean up your act. Clearly, we had more cases than we knew how to bring. But it's clearly better to ask the industry, whatever you want to call the industry, to correct itself rather than and then turn over the work product, and you don't get immunity from that, but if you did a responsible job, you got credit for that, and that credit was there, and it was given out.
Did that program wind down as a matter of course, or were the brakes put on at some point?
Probably a little of both. I don't think of anything actively happening in terms of being brakes. The Congress passed the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in 1977, and at that point in time, I think it was universally accepted, certainly in the United States, that we should not be promoting corruption. We as a country should not be promoting corruption around the world. And any more than we wanted to promote corruption in Maryland or New Jersey or California or New York, we weren't going to promote corruption as a way to do business anywhere in the world. That was, I think, a significant step in corporate transparency and something that at first the business community was reluctant to accept. But Congress made it public policy, and I think most public corporations said, we'll comply. And
how active was the SEC in some of the hearings that were going on? There was a Senate subcommittee, there was a House subcommittee, all moving.
The commission was as active as could be. I mean, I wasn't actively involved in that, but it's clear from the hearings that, you know, there were various. I mean, I want to say that both Harold Williams and Rod Hills and I think Bill Casey to some extent were involved in that. Casey, I guess, had left by then. This commission or the staff put together a report in 1976, which pulled together all the then pending cases, cataloged where they were, I think supported the legislation. I want to say it was largely the result of Congressman Moss and Senator Proxmire, at least the way I remember it.
Was it your sense that the FCC was out in front of this or coming up behind?
Well, I think the commission was in front of this. I mean, there are very few situations I can think of, certainly during my period, where the Congress has been ahead of the commission. Whether you look at Sarbanes-Oxley, it's a little of carrot and stick, but at the same time, I mean, the commission didn't create Enron or WorldCom. They collapsed because there were major restatements of financial statements, and what created those particular ones, the Congress followed with Sarbanes-Oxley. The Foreign Corrupt Practices Act clearly was a result of the commission being ahead of the curve, and then at the same time asleep at the switch. I mean, you can argue, well, why did it take you 30 years to figure out that there was political corruption at the highest level with the largest corporations? Was that unknown? And I think you have to go back to, you know, what has evolved today into a form of federal corporate governance from what was, a very different climate. And if you go back, I'm not sure about my dates, but when I joined the commission in the mid-60s, corporate issuers weren't required to register with the commission unless there were certain reporting obligations. So they were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And NASDAQ didn't exist. There was something called the over-the-counter market, and it wasn't regulated very heavily. And over a period of the last 40 years, you have an acceptance by the Congress of the notion that these are public companies using public money, and they have an accountability that's required of them. And that didn't happen just in Sarbanes-Oxley, but it was an evolution that went forward. And, you know, many times people would say, oh, that's state law. It's governed by state law. The SEC has no business in it. You don't hear that too often today.
Yeah. I've heard the 70s, somebody described that as something of a golden age for the Division of Enforcement, certainly, and for the SEC in some sense. I mean, you are in a period where the role of the corporation in American society is more in question probably than at any time since the 30s. And the SEC is right in the middle of it, as you described. from your position, you were working inside, was there a sense that this was the case, and was there a sense that the commission was leading this?
I certainly think it was one of the commission's finest moments, whether it was the golden age as distinguished from other periods. I think of the commission as having any number of golden ages, so to speak. I think that I look at, you know, the enforcement program today, post Sarbanes-Oxley, and I certainly think that it has a very robust and effective enforcement program. Some people would say, as they said when we were there, it's too robust and it's too effective and it's too harsh and it's a lot of other things. And I might say that myself in a particular case, but I think that the commission has historically had a very small enforcement program, a very small agency. I remember when I was there, when I started, I think it had less than 2,000 employees, which was minuscule by government standards. I was amazed at how effective 2,000 people could be and how many headlines you could grab and for what purpose. I always thought that its golden age was its political independence and its lack of involvement in the politics of the day. No matter who was president, everyone tried to influence in one way or another, but staff usually did the right thing, and no matter who was the president, and I don't think that's changed. I think it was in a golden age in the sense that this was the age when Stanley Sporkin led the enforcement division and led it a very effective enforcement program, probably one of the finest enforcement programs that the commission or any government agency has had. But I think that doesn't diminish the fact that as the commission has gone through the 80s and the 90s and now the decade of the first of the 20th century, 21st century, I think that it's got equally important challenges. You can take a look at different things that have been highlights, but you think about how many billions of shares are traded now and what was considered small amounts then. The age of the computer has made it possible for us to do this all electronically. We had back office problems in the 60s and 70s. They couldn't handle a couple million shares a day. And I think that it's a credit to the agency and its personnel that they've been able to be as responsive to it.
We come back to the lawyers again. With the Carter Johnson case, and it must have seemed different to you from some of those early cases you discussed, because by this time you've got access theory having been developed during the 70s, and so the implications of bringing action against lawyers must have seemed a little bit more than just this one-off approach that you did.
Well, I think Carter Johnson is not really a question of the access theory. Carter Johnson raises the question of what is a lawyer's role when he or she or his or her law firm finds itself in a situation where they give good advice to the client and the management chooses to ignore it by continuing to violate the securities laws. And oversimplifying Carter Johnson a bit, you have a series of public statements being made by management that are essentially being ignored by, you have a series of public statements being made against the advice of the lawyer, and the lawyer advice being ignored, and ultimately it being perceived of that the lawyer's role is acquiescence, if you like. And so the commission staff came up with a theory that it was incumbent upon the lawyer to go to the board of directors. And this came out of some of the ethical rules that were then in effect, that was then called, the Model Code. And it had a provision that talked about the lawyer having an obligation when he or she works for a public company to go to the board of directors and apprise them of certain things that might be viewed as injurious to the corporation, one of which, in Carter Johnson, being the violation of the securities laws by the management in the face of and in defiance of the advice of the law firm. The staff put forth that position and litigated it, and convinced an administrative law judge that indeed that was a requirement. That was appealed to the commission, and if I remember correctly, the commission punted. The commission decided they weren't going to decide the issue. They decided that it was not incumbent upon them to set professional standards for the legal profession. That the case itself had brought enough attention to the issue, and therefore it was not necessary for the commission to spell out what the professional obligations of lawyers were. It was also accompanied by, I'm not sure of the sequence, but there was a fairly celebrated case brought against a fellow named George Kern at the same time, who was a partner, I want to say, of Sullivan and Cromwell, that raised similar issues about what is the lawyer's role and responsibility. And the commission there, too, decided that they would not promulgate specific rules or regulations, didn't really think it was incumbent upon them, nor was it their place, recognizing that basically lawyers are licensed by the state authorities rather than by the federal government. And regulation of lawyers, in a sense, took a back seat for a number of years as different things evolved. Some of that I frankly attribute to changes in personnel. Ed Green, who became the general counsel, made a speech in which he essentially said, we're going to leave lawyers alone. He didn't quite say it that way, but that was the thrust of it. And there were very few lawyer cases brought, and I think Ed thought that that was appropriate under the circumstances. And I think he said just a few weeks ago at the SEC Speaks pretty much the same thing, although he would have phrased it differently. Certainly the effort to go after major lawyers and partners of major firms pretty much stopped for a while. And then
did the Reagan administration coming in and making some personnel changes, did that have something to do with this?
I don't think that either the Reagan administration or the Bush administration, either the first or the second Bush administration, really, I don't think that was part of their agenda. I think you get people, I respect Ed Green. I think the world of him as a lawyer. I think he had a different approach when Nixon was president. Bill Casey came in. He had three assistants who were all from Wall Street firms. And some of them I was able to convince that national student marketing made sense, and some of them I wasn't. I worried about their, you know, putting a kibosh on it, and was pleasantly surprised when they turned out to be open-minded and willing to listen to the arguments and make decisions, and I found them to be generally supportive. And I think that's true for the most part. I don't think that, I mean, if anything, now, today, in 2005, you have a congressional mandate in Sarbanes-Oxley which calls for the commission to regulate lawyers who practice before it, plain and simple. And now the commission is confronted with and remains confronted with the issue of whether to memorialize the so-called blow-the-whistle concept that is embodied in the national student marketing case, which really hasn't been accepted by the legal profession since 1972. And the commission, the accounting profession, can in 1995, with the enactment of the Securities Litigation Reform Act, and specifically Section 10, capital A, was mandated to blow the whistle on its clients, meaning that if the accountants tried to correct a situation and couldn't get the management to correct it and couldn't get the board of directors to correct it, they had an obligation to come to the commission and report the misconduct. And the commission, after Sarbanes-Oxley, proposed what really is the blow-the-whistle solution for lawyers. The commission got a boatload of adverse comments about it, concluded not to adopt it, hasn't abandoned it. It is still, I think, a live rule proposal that they might come to, but they probably don't need to deal with. I think that the current climate is such that the commission has, for all practical purposes, told the legal profession that that's what they expect of them.
So this is the issue, essentially, I guess, that has been dropped with Carter and Johnson.
I don't think it was dropped with Carter and Johnson. I think that Carter Johnson was an abandonment of a particular approach to the practice of law. I think that most corporate lawyers, both in Carter Johnson, before Carter Johnson, and afterwards, recognized that they represented the corporation and not just the management. And indeed, if the management decided to do something stupid, they had a duty to report it. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of ethics to figure out that if you have a CEO who's stealing money from the corporation, you have a duty to report it. And even if he's your best friend and he's hired you, if he says to you, I've been taking $100,000 out of the kitty every year without any vouchers or any support, you've got an obligation to report that to someone. And you can't let that continue.
Well, by the time that these things worked out, you would have been, I've left the SEC and moved on to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. What was behind that decision?
Oh, pretty simple. I mean, a couple things happened. Roberta Carmel became a commissioner. I dearly love Roberta. I've known her for years. She had a style about her that was very antagonistic. I was convinced at some point that either she would leave or Stanley Sworkin would have a heart attack. I went to many commission meetings with great frustration, and at some point, I think probably Roberta wanted it for one thing. We had a long trial in the National Student Marketing case. I thought we had won the case. The court had bought most of our legal theories, and then I heard Roberta suggest at a commission meeting that sometime in the late 70s that we ought to confess error in the Court of Appeals, and I thought that was a ghastly idea. Fortunately, she was only a voice of one. Commission didn't do that, but I could see that things were becoming very divisive. What happened is a good friend of mine, a fellow named Charlie Curtis, who had been on the staff of the commission years and years back and had gone to the Hill, became the chairman of FERC. He became the chairman of FERC under the Carter administration, and he had tried to set up an enforcement program at FERC. The first enforcement director got herself into a fair amount of trouble, and Charlie said, "She's left, and would you like to try to come over and help?" It sounded like a challenge. I had no idea whether Carter was going to get elected. Re-elected, rather, but it sounded like a good way to move on, and so I moved on, and that was why I left. And I was afraid Stanley was going to get carried out with a heart attack from Roberta.
That eventually didn't happen.
No.
Looking back, it looks like the idea of the lawyers and accountants cases, which is something we started out with and something we ended it with, was something of a common thread. How did you see that change over the years? And what would you like to have remembered for your contribution?
Well, I think that I'd like to think that my contribution was in some small part responsible for bringing better practices to both the accounting and legal profession. I think that the fact that we continue to see regular failures by lawyers and accountants even today means that I've only made a small dent in that, if at all. I take some comfort in the fact that Congress has finally decided to give the Commission express statutory authority over both the lawyers and the accountants. At the same time, frankly think it's a terrible idea. I mean that. I think that I feel less so about it for the accounting profession, but as a lawyer, I find myself both in private practice and in the government. You are, in a sense, you have an enormous amount of power. You have an opportunity to abuse it. You try to be conscientious. The people that keep you honest are the lawyers on the other side. And I know that from my own experience. I see too many cases where the government has overreached for one reason or another it happens today. It happened when we were there. I was, you know, horrified to find situations where cases were brought against individuals, and I or somebody on my staff was responsible for trying the case, and lo and behold, there was no evidence. It wasn't that somebody was mean and vindictive or corrupt. It meant that somebody hadn't done a very conscientious job of going through and finding out what the evidence was against a particular individual, and that was a tragedy.
You were just bringing a little bit of perspective on the fact that having the government set standards for lawyers, there can be a downside to it.
Right. Right. But why don't... why?
Probably not something that you dwelled on during your time with the SEC.
No, I did. A fair amount. Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's changed. I don't think... my job hasn't changed. I do as much, Ken, on the defense side as a prosecutor, because if I'm hired by an audit committee or a public company and I've got to decide whether to fire somebody or do something worse... It doesn't change. I just think that I'll tie it up, but I mean, I think that the concluding thought is, you know, you see people who are still being detained in Guantanamo and haven't had a hearing. And I don't care what the politics of it are. At some point, the system's got to deal with that. And, you know, the fact that some federal judge, I mean, still have the same problem. Is there enough evidence against it? And I don't think the I don't think the country is better off having the SEC or any other government agency regulate the conduct of lawyers, because it's subject to abuse, that's all.
And I guess we might see how it goes to some extent with Sarbanes-Oxley. Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.